This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are Nick Kroll and John Mulaney, two comics and actors who often work as a duo. Their latest project together is the Netflix animated comedy series Big Mouth, about a group of kids going through puberty, figuring out how to deal with all the related body changes, sexual urges, embarrassment, confusion, and frustration. Kroll and Mulaney voice the characters of two kids who are best friends. Kroll also co-created the series. Kroll and Mulaney also wrote and performed the show Oh Hello on Broadway. Mulaney was a writer on Saturday Night Live and co-created and co-wrote Bill Hader's character, Stefan. Kroll hosted the Comedy Central series The Kroll Show. In the movie Loving, Kroll played the young ACLU lawyer. Kroll and Mulaney met in an improv group while they were in college. Nick Kroll, John Mulaney, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. So let's talk about your animated series, Big Mouth. An animated series about a group of friends going through puberty, having a difficult time dealing with the physical and emotional changes. And Nick, you co-created, co-wrote, and star in it. And John, you're one of the stars in it. You play best friends. Nick, you created the series with a longtime friend. How did you decide to do a series about the changes of puberty?
My friend Andrew Goldberg, who I've known since first grade, and we became best friends in middle school. He also came out to Los Angeles and became a writer for Family Guy. And he came to me with two friends he worked with, Mark Levin, Jennifer Flackett. And they came to me one day with an idea about an animated show about the Andrew and I in that sort of middle school period. And it immediately resonated with me as a really interesting area for a show, especially animation. And so we kept talking and built it into this thing that really became about kids going through puberty, or in my particular case, not going through puberty, because I was a very late bloomer, whereas Andrew hit puberty very young, very hard. He had a mustache by like sixth, seventh grade, which his father made his mother wax off. And there were many years where he could grow a full beard except on his upper lip, like a little spot right in the middle of his lip, which we eventually jokingly called a reverse Hitler stash. And so it was really about these two boys who could be best friends but be in incredibly different places physically, and the challenges of both of those things.
So your character is based on you. John Mulaney, you play Andrew, the aforementioned friend of Nick's.
Yes.
You want to describe your character on the show?
My character, Andrew, is in rapid puberty mode, as the real and amazing writer Andrew Goldberg went through. There's a lot of body hair appearing. There's a lot of compulsions appearing. And what's great about Big Mouth is these are echoed always by the character of the hormone monster, voiced by Nick, who sort of lives in Andrew's brain and next to him as a creature, just kind of symbolizing all of the very mixed, weird feelings young Andrew is having and a lot of the physical manifestations.
Yeah, I think when we were discussing the show, Andrew and Mark and Jen were originally talking like about the idea that, you know, there's this guy who sort of an essence that's around Andrew, you know, like a kind of like a hormone monster. And then they approached me about it and they were like, we think there should be sort of like a hormone monster. And I immediately just said, touch yourself, Andrew. And that became sort of that it was like, okay, great. And this is why you can do something like this animated, is because you can then begin to personify these feelings and emotions that are kind of destroying and helping to form all these kids.
You're a 13-year-old and you're going through life looking like a 13-year-old, and inside you, you know, the Burning Man festival is going on.
And the hormone monster is personified as this like dragon-like creature that Nick you voice.
Yes.
And it's always kind of like egging everybody, you know, egging the two guys on to like, go ahead and kiss her, or like, go ahead, watch more porn, and do
but
things
then
that you can't mention on the radio. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. But then occasionally critiquing Andrew, which I've always liked, you know, because it's an id that I don't know enough about Freudian language. It's an id that also has a superego. It's an id that has a conscience, I'll say.
Yes.
Sometimes goes like, whoa, 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 whoa. Which I think is how you feel in puberty. You're like, this is natural. I should do this. Is this natural? Should I do this? Yeah.
So I want to play a clip. This is from the first episode of Big Mouth, which is, by the way, on Netflix. And your two characters are talking about, like, who knows how to kiss, who's actually already kissing girls. So you're talking about kissing, and here's the clip.
Jay hasn't even kissed a girl, I guarantee it. None of us have. Not, you know, with tongue anyway.
Of course, because when you do kiss a girl, to make it official...
there's gotta be tongue.
Major tongue.
And you want to flick your tongue around.
Ideally.
And you really want to get your tongue underneath hers,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah, you want to get in there like a Claritin to just dissolve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We know what we're talking about.
It's nice to talk like men.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first kiss?
I do.
Yes.
My first kiss was a truth or dare and so I don't even know if that counts, but I was on the back of a bus on a way back from a bar mitzvah, and it was with my friend Lizzie Gould, who the character of Jesse, voiced by Jesse Klein, is based on loosely. And it was, I didn't know what I was doing, and I just jammed my tongue down her throat. And I felt very strongly, made it very clear that I was not doing it right. And I, in later years, have been like, yep, that's very fair. That's a very fair critique.
And John, yours?
Oh, yes. I kissed a girl named Mary who I had a huge crush on. And when I had a crush, it was, you know, like stop the presses crush. Everyone had to know. I had to tell her and everyone around her and everyone in school and put billboards up about it. They were exhausting. And she was my eighth grade crush. And I did get to kiss her once. And that was the only time. I was not able to ever play anything cool. So I might have been like, thank you for kissing me. Oh, I love you so much.
And I think in the first episode, I have my first kiss, and it sort of reenacts that sort of just throwing my tongue into her mouth. In the second episode, it is actually based on our friend Liz. She told us after we had created the show, she's like, you know, I actually got my period for the first time on a class trip to the Statue of Liberty. And we thought that would make a great second episode, because I think our goal was to create a show about what it's like for boys going through puberty, because we were boys and we understand that, but also take an equal look at what it's like for girls and women, the process of going through puberty, which I think has not been quite as explored in most like popular culture.
So in this episode where the class is on a class trip to the Statue of Liberty and Jesse gets her first period while wearing white shorts, because her mother made her wear white shorts to school that day. It's a horrible experience for her. And on the bus ride home, the school bus ride home, it's animated so you could do this. You have a tampon walking down the aisle of the bus, singing in the manner of R.E.M., Everybody Bleeds, to the melody of Everybody Hurts. And I want to play a clean verse from that.
Good luck.
we got one. Here we go.
Yes.
Now you're not alone, 'cause everybody bleeds from time to time. So let it flow. Shameful stain on the white bands of your heart, and everybody bleeds like your insides are exploding. Everybody bleeds, life's all heartache, cramps, and bloating. Everybody bleeds.
Everybody, what are you, out of your minds? Get back on the bus.
That last verse you heard was Nick Kroll as the clueless coach
who's overseeing the bus.
Sorry, that weird moment is actually Fred Armisen doing the bus driver in that particular moment.
Oh, that's the bus driver. Okay, I'm remembering it as the coach. Okay.
Yes, no, but I do like a couple things. One, if someone just turned on, like, was like, when I get in my car and it's just on NPR and Fresh Air comes on and they hear that song.
They think that's the incidental music.
Yeah.
Part of this episode is about how upsetting the idea of menstruation is for boys who are just learning about it. And John, your character is just kind of traumatized by the idea, trying to help.
But yes, very shaken up. Andrew is.
Was it upsetting for you when you learned about it?
I wouldn't say it was upsetting to learn about menstruation. I will admit I fainted during the Miracle of Life video. During the actual reveal, that's a medical term, when the baby came out, I was like, huh, what is happening there? And then I hit the floor. And that didn't happen once, Terry. That happened three times.
Three separate years.
Did they make you watch that? Did you fail the first time and they kept showing it to you subsequent years?
What? They should have, because one must see and know.
Yeah.
But I was not prepared at that moment. We're just happily watching this video that was, I think, made in 1972 with era-appropriate clothing. And the first time I was like, what's that? And I hit the floor. The second time was like, I think they're going to show that video again. Got to play it cool. Don't faint. And then I fainted. And then the third year, everyone was looking at me being like, he's going to faint as soon as the baby comes out. And the pressure of all of that, I think, gave me a panic attack and I collapsed.
My guests are comics and actors John Mulaney and Nick Kroll. They voice the characters of two best friends in the Netflix animated comedy series Big Mouth, which Kroll co-created. So John told us a little bit about his experience learning the facts of life in school and fainting. Mm.
Yes.
What was your experience? Like, who taught you, Nick?
Well, I had two older sisters and an older brother. And so I definitely got some really good information from my... I mean, I remember seeing one of my older sisters getting her period. I mean, not seeing it, but I remember her crying in the bathroom. And I was probably like 7 or 8 at the time. But I remember I have weird flashes of... You know how you have like screen grabs of moments. And so I remember that. I definitely learned, I would feel very grateful for having older sisters because I feel like they were very helpful to, older sisters are incredibly helpful to younger brothers in explaining how things are happening and what women are thinking. And I was very grateful for that. In school, I don't remember a ton of information from school. I mean, I remember, Andrew and I remember watching a video called like, Am I Normal? And there was I remember a couple boys walking along and then they see a janitor at their school and there's two animals having sex and the janitor points out the animals having sex, which now seems like a sex crime video in some way. But at the time was supposed to sort of explain what was happening in a very indirect way.
So Nick, since you had older sisters, did they kind of warn you about being crude or condescending or harassing two girls?
Yeah, and I think, you know, as much as older sisters can help younger brothers in that way, and then younger brothers have to figure out their way through it. And we actually, I'll point to another episode in the season, I think it's episode 7 called The Head Pusher. And it's all about the idea of truly consent. And my older sister in the show, Leah, played by Kat Dennings, has a boy that she likes and they start making out and then he pushes her head down to do something that she doesn't want to do. And she sort of says, I don't want to do that. And he tries it again. And then she ends it. And then there's a discussion amongst all of the kids about, you know, how do you get someone to do that thing you want to do? And Leah says, well, you ask. And the younger boys are in this conversation too. And they're like, that seems very uncomfortable. And it's like, well, then you don't get that. And it's like, well, fair enough. I'd rather just not have that conversation, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I think in that episode, that conversation happens in a Seinfeld diner.
Yes, it then turns into a Seinfeld thing about the head push, you know? Not a fan of the head push. But it was, I think it was emblematic of a bunch of stuff, and this was before everything that sort of happened in recent, or all the revelations of the last year, but we wrote it before that. And I'm incredibly grateful that I had older sisters to help me navigate that stuff.
John, did you have older sisters?
I have an older sister and an older brother and a younger sister. And I think while we didn't talk about sex much at home ever, except during, like, if we were watching Working Girl and our parents were like, get out of the room right now, that would come up. But in my development as a human, they were absolutely essential, even if we might have been a little uptight.
So, John, there's an episode in which you think you might be gay because you've watched a video with The Rock and you feel aroused by it and you think, like, okay.
I forgot
okay.
It was The Rock.
Yeah.
Like, okay, maybe I'm gay. So you don't know how to tell if you're gay or not. So you go to your friend from school who is gay, who's voiced by Andrew Rannells, and ask him for advice. So I want to play that scene.
Hey, Matthew?
Oh, look, the lost and found became a person.
I was wondering, if you don't mind, how did you know that you were, gay? Sorry, you're the only gay person I know.
I'm the only gay person you know. Why are we talking about this? Oh, you think you're gay.
What? No. Well, yeah, I'm not sure.
No. I can see it. I mean, you suck at being straight.
Hi, Andrew. I just wanted to preemptively let you know that I'm not interested in you.
And may I say that I fully understand, and I thank you for your candor.
You're welcome.
That too. You're weirdly formal. Like the kind of gay guy who was in the Air Force and then became middle management at IBM, and you have a condo, and there's like a sad gym in the building.
Well, that sounds like a nice little life I've made for myself.
Let's face it, Andrew. If you're asking, you're probably gay.
Probably gay? Well, what does that even mean?
Not my job. I have morning announcements, and you have, like, a pear shape.
Oh, God.
It's a scene from Big Mouth, which you heard the voice of my guest, John Mulaney, and Andrew Rannells, also with us, is Nick Kroll, who co-created this series and plays one of the leads in it. John, in your stand-up comedy, you've talked about how people assumed that you were gay when you were coming of age. Why did they assume that, and what was that experience like for you?
I think maybe due to very surface-level things that are stereotypical and not nuanced or very sophisticated. Just, I wasn't athletic, maybe didn't seem as masculine as they thought. I'm not sure. But obviously, those are things that I guess maybe, as a teenager, people would pick up on and go, like, you're bad at basketball, but nothing of substance. I had good self-esteem, and I would be absolutely remiss to say I was not bullied in any way for that. And it was, I think, a thing people would joke about occasionally. And I was weirdly formal, as Andrew is
yes.
on the show.
Did you think maybe I am gay?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I think that was I think I think that's the truth. Is a lot of people, especially in when you're all of a sudden thrust into sort of sexuality and desire. I think it would be untrue for most people to be like, at some point, be like, where am I on this sexual spectrum? Where am I falling?
Like, why am I not like him? Why am I not? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, why am I not purely just going after this one thing, or what does this all mean? And I think kids are struggling with that at that age. And truthfully, as you see people going through your life, like, people are figuring it out throughout the rest of their lives. And I think we wanted to sort of address that concept, that sexuality. I don't think we're trying to formally say sexuality is on a spectrum, but I think that, like, you know, it's like, I mean, I've had those questions where I'm like, well, geez, I've been best friends with John for a long time. I love hanging out with him. I don't know if I want to sleep with him, but I really love spending time with him. What does that mean about me? And I hope John's wife is listening to this.
And I don't get the second part. Why are you unclear on whether you want to sleep with
him? It's been so much fun to talk with you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Terry, we love listening to Fresh Air, both of us, and to be on it is like a true, true milestone for both of us. So thank you for having us.
Nick Kroll and John Mulaney voice the characters of two best friends in the Netflix animated comedy series Big Mouth, which Kroll co-created. In April, the late singer, songwriter, and pianist Nina Simone will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In anticipation, two compilations of Simone's early singles have been released. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the music and editing show how her early producers sought to shape her image.
Plain gold ring on his finger he wore. It was where everyone could see. He belonged to someone, but not me. On his head was a plain gold band. Plain gold ring had a story to tell. It was one.
Nina Simone, 1957. She once said, "I play jazz and blues, but they are not mine," calling her style African-rooted classical music. Playing to her several strengths, Simone tailored an individual style that didn't fall into any one category. But two new singles collections show how her early producers placed her in one box after another. As a young, classically trained pianist, she'd played in bars to pay the bills and started singing because that was expected. And then as a black woman who sang and played in nightclubs, she got pegged as a jazz musician. So her first album was for a swinging trio with Tootie Heath on drums. As pianist, she could work a rhythm groove, and she incorporated her classical chops with grace and wit. Simone's first label, Bethlehem, had a hit with her I Loves Your Porgy and would release her entire debut album, Little Girl Blue, as a series of singles. The longer tracks were bluntly edited to radio length. So while archival reissues often contain extra material, Nina Simone's Mood Indigo, complete Bethlehem singles, actually contains less music from her first session. The full version of Mood Indigo, for example, begins with a trio romp that artfully sets up her vocal. The single just starts with the vocal. Those edits carve away improvised content to spotlight Simone the singer. At 24, she had power and knew how to frame it. You can hear Joni Mitchell coming in her long low notes.
Sit there, count the raindrops falling on you. It's time.
Nina Simone quickly moved on to a bigger label. Her other new compilation, the Coal Picks singles, was recorded between 1959 and 63. Trawling for any approach that might click with record buyers, Coal Picks A and B sides found her in all sorts of settings, with sweet studio orchestra or punching big band, with choirs and strings or spare percussion, with a rock and roll feel, or on stage with her band. She even did an answer song to a Ray Charles hit. On a woodwinds-laced Willow Weep for Me, the young Nina betrays a debt to Billie Holiday. Listen to the little flip she gives the word, lovely.
Gone my lover's dream, lovely summer dream. Gone and left me here to weep my tears into the stream. Sad as I can be, hear me willow and weep for me.
Nina Simone's Coal Picks singles might reflect her own perceptions of a changing audience. Some clubs she worked booked jazz and folk acts, and she was drawing listeners from both camps. The singles edit of one performance from the Newport Jazz Festival, coming in on Al Shackman's strumming guitar, pitched Nina as a folk song revivalist. The songs from 1879.
In the evening, by the moonlight, you could hear banjos ringing. You can hear the by the moonlight, you could hear my folks all singing. How my mother, she would enjoy it. She would sit all night and listen as we sang in the evening by the moonlight. Oh, oh yeah. In the evening by the moonlight, you could hear folks all singing.
In the evening by the moonlight touches on another key to Nina Simone's mature music, the gospel feel and fervor she absorbed as a child pianist in her mom's country church. Simone really came into her own after leaving Coal Picks in 1964. Soon after, she recorded her sardonic civil rights anthem, Mississippi Goddamn, taking possession of her image. Simone earned her spot in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She supplied the Animals with a couple of hits, but she was no more a regulation rocker than she was a straight jazz, classical, gospel, or folk musician. Nina Simone stood a little aside from all of that, a singular artist with something for everyone.
Come on back, Jack. Hey, Jack, come on back. When I told you I was through and I told him to move on, I didn't know I'd miss you so, but baby, I was wrong. Those nights without your love, they ain't worth thinking of. So come on back, Jack. Hey, Jack, come on, come on back. Come on back, Jack. Hey, Jack, come on, come on back.
Oh, woman, save your breath. Little woman, save your breath.
Come on back, Jack. Hey, Jack, come on, come on back.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed two compilations of Nina Simone's early singles on Bethlehem and Coal Picks. Simone will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in April. It's likely you've seen our next guest in a TV show or in a movie. He has over 150 acting credits listed on IMDb, but it's also likely you would not recognize him or know his name. That's because he's often wearing a mask, or horns, or a complete bodysuit that has transformed him into some sort of amphibious fish man monster. That's actually his latest role. Doug Jones plays the aquatic creature in Guillermo del Toro's latest film, The Shape of Water. The film has 13 Oscar nominations this year, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay. The film takes place in 1962 and stars Sally Hawkins as Eliza, a mute woman who works cleaning a secret U.S. government facility. One laboratory is performing experiments on a strange amphibious creature, played by Doug Jones, that was captured in the Amazon. The creature is part fish, part man, and is now living in a large fish tank in the lab. Eliza is intrigued by the creature, befriends it, and an unconventional romance blooms. Jones has suited up for other Del Toro films, including both Hellboy movies and Pan's Labyrinth. He also has a leading role in the latest Star Trek series, Discovery. For some roles, the makeup required to transform Jones into his character takes over 5 hours. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
Well, Doug Jones, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
So you've played a lot of things from people's nightmares, monsters, creatures. You're still playing a creature in the new movie, The Shape of Water, but you're also the romantic lead. Was that a surprise to you to get that role?
Indeed. I never saw romantic leading male coming with any creature roles after 31 years of playing them now.
Well, did you have any apprehensions about playing the romantic lead?
I did, just simply because when Guillermo presented this to me, it was going to get a little saucy, you know, when he said, oh, no, you're going to get it on. And I was like, how involved does that get? And he mentioned that there was a bathtub involved. And I said, well, how about you start at the beginning of the story and get me to the tub? And then he didn't have a script written yet, and he just kind of told me the story verbally. And he started telling me the tale of this 1962 backdrop. You know, Russian Cold War's in full effect. The race for space is on. And I am an asset that has been pulled from the Amazon, a fish man who was worshipped as a god locally by the locals there in South America, and brought back to this U.S. government facility for testing and for prodding and for biopsying and for what can we do with this? How can we use this being in this race for space? The story begins, though, really, when Sally Hawkins, who plays a cleaning lady on a night shift at this government facility, discovers me, finds a kinship with me immediately, comes back to visit me on her lunch breaks, shares her lunch time with me, teaches me to love hard-boiled eggs, and teaches me to love music. She brings a portable record player with her, and I discover music for the first time. It's just this romance builds out of it. Then, of course, we got to the tub, but then I was still like, well, tell me the rest of the story. How does it end? So he took me through all the way to the end, and I was just like, you know, wiping tears and saying, oh, my gosh, Guillermo.
Well, I heard in the conversations you had with Guillermo del Toro about how to play this role that he said the character is part matador. How did you incorporate that into your performance? Like, how did that make you think about how you were going to move?
Well, he wanted to see no traces of a couple things first. He wanted to see no trace of human. Mm-hmm. He wanted him to really see an ecosystem that came from another place, another world, another species. He wanted to see a heroic stance that would warrant why I was worshipped as a god in the Amazon. So that would mean that comes with a certain regalness and a certain, royalty kind of posturing. So I had to incorporate all that into this. And he said, and while you're at it, sprinkle in some matador. So I'm like, oh, okay. I understood exactly what he meant immediately, though. Matadors, if you ever see a bullfighting toreador and how graceful they are and how confident they are and how they lead with the hips and the pelvis, and it's sexy and graceful all at the same time and very athletic and very fearless. He said, that's how I want you to be. So that's kind of what I did. I kind of worked on leading with the pelvis, which is something that in my normal life I just don't do. I'm a tall, skinny, goofy guy that doesn't. I never lead with the pelvis, so that was kind of retraining myself. And the non-human parts of this, I didn't speak a word of dialogue. So the entire, nor did Sally Hawkins, as her character was mute. So between the two of us, we had lots of visual dialogue to convey, and. So
yeah, what does that mean? I saw that in a note that there was a lot of visual dialogue.
Right. Well, when you think about dialogue and people communicating, so much of our communication is visual. How you hold your hands, how you're postured, what your body language is, expressions on your face, the tilt of the head, that can change all the words you say. So with that came just a heart-to-heart, soul-to-soul kind of communication. And I could not use my human instincts to respond. Mm-hmm. So if someone's talking to me, I had to think like, okay, so when you talk to the dog, when you talk to the family dog, you're such a good boy, Fluffy. The dog does not say, yes, Daddy, I am a good boy, and give you a thumb up. They tilt their head, they raise their ears, they wag their tail, they rough at you. So they have their own ecosystem to respond with. So I had to find my own ecosystem with with this Fishman character. And that's kind of what helped me, was to think of the family dog.
So you're wearing this elaborate suit and prosthetic makeup on your face. How much did that hamper, like, your movement or your vision or your hearing on set?
Any creature suit that I've worn over the last 31 years has been, it hampers your eyesight, your hearing. You basically become a nursing home patient. You know, you need help getting around. And the irony of that is that you're playing someone, usually playing a being that has superhuman strength.
Right, right.
So, but you need help walking to the set. Huh. So this was no different. I also was, my vision was very impaired and my hearing. My ears were covered with latex foam rubber, and the gills were right next to my ears as well. So, and they were mechanically operated. So I would hear in my ears as the scene is progressing. So you have to kind of blot that out. Yeah, it's not there.
I watched a video of you getting the makeup on to play one of your other famous roles, the Fawn in Pan's Labyrinth. And, you know, to call it makeup doesn't really do justice to the transformation you go through. But I mean, but fortunately, the video was sped up because it looked like it must have just taken hours to get
it did.
This whole thing on. I mean, it sounds like from what I read, some of these things take 5 or 6 hours. I mean, you must have just an incredible amount of patience to go through these sessions.
Well, I guess so. I'm also happy with my own thoughts. I don't have to really, like, be patient. I never think those words. I'm always happy being quiet and sitting still. If no emails or phone calls can get to me for 5 hours, great. You know, it's really kind of like a peaceful time.
Well, so then you're in getting set up for some filming, and it takes 5, 6, 7 hours of makeup. And then how long do you actually often in the suit for filming that day?
Right. A head-to-toe transformation, often you're looking at, 5 hours is about right. Normally, because you mentioned the Fawn from Pan's Labyrinth, that was a five-hour makeup transformation. The Pale Man from Pan's Labyrinth with my eyes and balls in my hands, I did play that character as well. That was a 6-hour transformation. The Shape of Water, though, was much more kinder and gentler. That was only 3 hours. But that's 3 hours on set when the makeup artists are applying the pieces to the actor. What happens beforehand is a huge share of the work. That would be all the sculpting, the molding, the running of pieces, the painting of those pieces ahead of time, so that the makeup artist on set can then blend the colors together with all the pieces that are now glued onto you. So once you're done with that makeup process, you still are looking at a 10 to 12 hour shoot day. Wow. And then you're looking at a teardown period. So now for the Shape of Water.
I hadn't even thought about the fact that you have to take
it off.
You got to
get out of it. Right, yeah. Yeah. Now the Shape of Water, the amphibian man that I played, was a quick one because it went on in only 3 hours. It was less glued down makeup and more suit. Therefore, it came off faster. So we got that off in about 40 minutes.
How do you deal with bathroom breaks?
Now there is a topic of the day. Everyone asks about this. So it depends on the creature. Every one of them is different. If there's zippers and things that can be pulled down, you're good to go. If it is a rubber suit from head to toe that is a creature that is not wearing clothing, like the amphibian man from The Shape of Water, now you're looking at hiding a front flap that I can go number one from. But that behind of mine, that backside of the fishman, which was very sexy, that sexy backside came at a cost. There was no back flap. So I had to take care of all that business ahead of time and make sure that I could make it through an 18-hour day without having to use that back. Right. So that creates...
That's just another level of stamina.
It just is. It's another thing. And it's a young man's game. And we were filming this with me at 56 years old. I'm 57 now. And I'm thinking, how many more of these do I want to do? You know.
Well, I was wondering about that. Yeah, as you're now in your mid 50s, you said 57. Like, how have you noticed that doing these roles takes more of a toll on your body?
Absolutely, no question about it. It does. Now, for The Shape of Water, I was in the best shape of my life. Because I knew what this movie meant. I knew that that with the regal athleticism of this character, that I needed to, even though it was sculpted on me, it was a beautiful suit that I slipped into, I still had to have the body underneath it that could carry it off, mm-hmm. you know? And so I did have to be in the best shape of my life. So I got through the movie fine, but it was those day-to-day comforts that I'm thinking, how much longer do I want to do without those? Like, I can't go to the craft service snack table like everybody else can. I can't grab a carrot when I want to. I've got these webbed fingers and I've got, you know, fish teeth in, and I've got, you know, rubber lips glued onto my own, and it's just snacking becomes a big mess. So, yeah, so I can't. So lunchtime comes. That's the one time a day I could go back to my trailer. They would unglue one of my hands so I could have a free human hand. Wow. And that's when I could negotiate the front flap of my suit to use the bathroom. But that was the one time of day that I could use the bathroom. So it's like you really had to time your water intake out and all mm-hmm, that kind of thing.
Well, add on top of that, it seems like you spend a lot of time partially submerged in water. And I mean, mm-hmm. did that get uncomfortable wearing this suit?
Well, sure. Foam latex rubber is what that suit's made of, so it does act as a sponge. It will soak up all of the water, and the water gets in a layer between me and the suit, mm-hmm. so it becomes like a wetsuit if you're a surfer. Now, the foam latex rubber is a bit buoyant, but it's getting out of the water. When you're trying to climb out, that's when you get heavy, because now I'm waterlogged and sponged up,
right?
And I weigh an extra 70 pounds. So it's like, oh, I can't even walk. How do people do this? You know?
So you're 6'3", and I'm not sure how much you weigh, but you're very skinny. Did you have a big growth spurt in high school, were you always tall?
Yeah, I've always been the tallest one in my class, so I didn't surprise anybody with my height. I've always been the tallest, and I did the usual junior high school kind of like growing fast and growing out of your pants. My pants were often too short. Hmm. And I only weigh 140 pounds.
140 pounds.
Guessing about that, yeah. Now, anyone else will tell you, at 6'3 and a half, 140 pounds is just this side of a cadaver. So I pull at the heartstrings of mothers all across the country. Oh, feed him. Would you like some pie?
So did you feel awkward in your body when you were younger?
Oh, I never felt not awkward. I was awkward every day in my body. I'm 57. I still feel awkward in my body. I'm owning it better now. But, but back then, it doesn't help either. When you're growing up in the Midwest and there's a certain sliver, a very, very narrow sliver of what's considered normal, what's considered cool. And if you're anything outside of that, you will be made fun of. That's just what kids do. So I was indeed made fun of. I was called giraffe. I was called ostrich. I had a very long, skinny pencil neck. Still do. And I defended myself with a sense of humor. I became mm-hmm. the class clown so that I could get to the laugh before they did. And that's kind of where my show business came from, was by a survival technique as a kid. Mm. Always felt awkward, yes. And so when I came out to Hollywoodland in 1985 and my first agent interview, the commercial lady sat across the desk from me and she said, "Oh my gosh, you have such a great look." Mm. Now, I heard her say, "You look really good." But what she said was, "You have a great look." There's a difference, I found out. But what my great look is, though, is that my geekiness, my characteriness, my unique tall, skinny pencil neck was very, very castable, very usable, very marketable mm-hmm. for a certain type of character acting. And it was kind of a way of celebrating, oh, good, I can actually put all this nonsense to use now. Oh, this is great. And someone's finding it attractive, even if it's a business sense attractive, but fine, I'll take it. And I did get my early inspiration and my early validation by being a goofy person from watching movies by Jerry Lewis and mm-hmm. Danny Kaye, and seeing Dick Van Dyke and Barney Fife played by Don Knotts, or Gilligan's Island, or Gomer Pyle. Those were goofy fellows that helped validate me when I look in the mirror and say, well, you know what, that they're not that far off from me, and they're making a career of it. They're making people laugh and feel good. They're making me feel good. They're giving me a hope to go back to school the next day. So if I can turn what I'm looking at in the mirror into the same kind of career, I'll be happy one day. And so lo and behold, here I am using my tall skinniness every day now.
What roles are you hoping for in the future? Are you hoping to get more screen time without so much makeup, or are you happy to continue forward? I mean, I know you're playing Count Orlok.
I am.
Which is the vampire. It's a remake of Nosferatu. So you are continuing down that path. But are you? What would you like to do next?
Well, that 5 years ago, that would have been my answer. I've never played a vampire. I would love to play Nosferatu. So now I have played Count Orlok in Nosferatu, and I can check that off my bucket list. That comes out later this year. Now, honestly, do you know what I'm longing for? Can I tell you?
Sure.
I told you I did do a Hallmark Channel movie before. I did a movie called The Ultimate Legacy with Raquel Welch. Was my boss lady, and I was her butler. I drove her in an old Rolls-Royce car, and I wore a three-piece suit with a bow tie and a watch chain. I was in heaven, right? I would love to do more of that. And in fact, I love, okay, I'm gonna let you know a little secret here, okay? And that is that I do love the Hallmark Channel. I love feel-good stories. I love low-stakes problems. I love happy endings. I love pretty people telling a pretty story in a pretty setting. I have no problem with any of the above. So, you know, kind of like when I was a kid and I looked at Jerry Lewis and Danny Kaye and I wanted to be a goofy guy in sitcoms and doing funny things. So I think the ultimate role that I would love to play that I haven't done yet, I would love to be the father of a grown daughter who comes to me for advice at Christmas time. I'm wearing a sweater with reindeer on it, and I'm swirling a cup of hot cocoa and giving her some really sound advice. What do you think of that?
That sounds good. And your own ears and no prosthetics.
That's right. With my own ears, no gills going while I'm having that conversation. Yes. Oh, can we do that?
Well, Doug Jones, thanks so much for being here.
It has been my absolute pleasure. You've been very, very delightful to talk with.
Doug Jones spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Jones plays the fish man creature in The Shape of Water, which is nominated for 13 Oscars, including Best Picture.